So for a few moments here, just pay attention to your breath, wherever you find it. And we're going to try and get real comfortable with the breath. We're not trying to do anything to it, to control it in any way. Every breath is a good breath. If you always look, find it in the same place, it'll be easy to come back to when you get lost, when you get distracted, and that will happen. So just pay attention to the breath, and if it helps, you can note by saying in, out, or rising, falling. But that's secondary. You always want to follow the physical sensation, and these notes or labeling, it's kind of like a transparent label. Only 5%. You see right through it to the physical sensation. And you can pay attention to everything, not just your breath, but what goes on in your body. If that becomes more important to you for a time, pay attention to that. And when you lose interest, go back to the breath. You can pay attention to your thoughts too, but without, you don't have to agree with yourself or disagree with yourself or stop the thoughts or just note them, just thinking, worrying, planning, hoping. You can even pay attention to how well you pay attention. Nothing is outside the scope of the practice. So just try following your breath, and I'll see you in a half an hour. Well, we've grown. More people here. Let's been sitting for a while. Let's get up and stretch the legs. Take a minute or two. That's about time to say hello to one or two people. And then we'll start with some announcements and then do our talk, okay? Are there any announcements? Well, I've got some. First, if you don't know about the bulletin board that's out there under the clock, it's got all kinds of great coming events for the next couple of months. Some highlights are on Friday the 24th of this month from 7 to 9, we're going to have our first anniversary celebration. And part of that will be a first anniversary celebration in this building. We've been together as a group for much longer. And part of that will be the installation of a statue that was commissioned by somebody and given to the Sangha. It's a figure of Mahaprajapata, I think. Anyway, famous, an early woman leader of the Sangha. And there are several half-day retreats coming up, Wednesday mornings, and some one-day retreats coming up. Check those out. One-day retreats, if you think you want to try something but you're not sure you want to try one day, just show up in the morning and leave at lunch. That always works. And if you're used to coming here on Thursdays, February 6th through March 6th, Richard Shankman will be here teaching a series of classes on the five hindrances. The hindrances are those things that make it hard for us to meditate. And knowing your enemy is always a good idea. So Richard has practiced a long time, studied this stuff formally. He's got a master's in Buddhist studies. A great guy, and if you're here for those nights, I'm sure you'll enjoy him. Anything else? I wanted to talk about the qualities of the Dhamma tonight, and I'll tell you how I got interested in that. Sometimes, special occasions, we may do it for our anniversary. We'll take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, or the teacher, the teachings, and the practitioners who keep it alive. And that goes, you know, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Sangham Saranam Gacchami. We always say it in Pali, which means I go to the Buddha for refuge, I go to the Dhamma for refuge, I go to the Sangha for refuge. And it's not really like a magical saying, like, oh, if I say this, everything's going to be okay, or I'm going to get in the car, so I better take refuge. But it's more of a call to remembrance of the qualities of the Dhamma that can, and the Buddha and the Sangha as well, that can be inspirations to us in our practice. And some people do this as part of their daily practice. The first thing they sit down is they take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And there's also a list of the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And it follows from a sutta that the Buddha gave. Several times he gave this list of qualities. Sometimes it's for the Buddha as being a perfectly self-enlightened and a great teacher. I kind of look at that personally as a... Buddha's not a god. He's a man. He's dead. He's gone. But he was gave us these great teachings, and he's a wonderful inspiration of what a person can do to try and understand the nature of reality and what goes on inside their head and why they're suffering and how to get out of it. And then the Sangha, that's it can be just it's certainly the ordained monks, but it's also anybody who's seriously practicing, and that includes us. And I think of the people that have kept this teaching alive for 2,500 years and the kind of the inspiration and the gratitude I have for them. I also think about those of us that are here and some of us that aren't. I mean, right now, one guy that used to sit right about there is in Sri Lanka. He's ordained as a nun. And another woman that went on the first retreat with me, she's in Burma for her second trip, and she'll come back and be a great asset here. And then there's just the people that say, gosh, was that hard? Was that hard for you too? And says, yeah, it was hard for me too. And they're all helping us. And then I think about the future generations and kind of part of our responsibility in helping out to make sure that the teachings get, you know, get preserved and handed down and strong and pure. I think about those too. But the thing that I want to talk about tonight is the qualities of the Dhamma. And I got interested in this because there's a chant in Pali that sometimes we do on a retreat, sometimes the last thing at night. And I'd be chanting this, you know, reading the Pali and then kind of looking over in the right-hand column of the translation. I said, oh, that's pretty cool. And I like the sound of the words, too. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about those tonight. So here's what the qualities of the Dhamma are. That's well expounded is the exalted one's Dhamma, to be seen here and now, timeless, inviting one to come and see, inward leading, to be seen by the wise for themselves. And that was actually taken by a sutta that the Buddha gave. And I'm going to talk about each of these in turn. And so these are my personal reflections, things that are important to me. They may not be important to you. You may disagree with them. That's fine. Just have your own opinion. I'd rather have you have one that's contrary to mine than not have one at all. And but I'd like to start with a little bit of perspective about another list of qualities of the Dhamma that the Buddha gave. And this is right after he got enlightened. got enlightened under the Bodhi tree, and then for 7 weeks he just kind of hung around in that area and meditated, enjoying what he had found and exploring it more deeply. And one time he said, "This Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see, hard to realize, peaceful, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the wise." And he was pretty discouraged. He said, it's deep, it's hard to see, hard to realize. He wasn't going to teach. He was just going to continue what he was doing, sitting around, enjoying what he had found. Not because he didn't have compassion for people, or because he didn't think he had something great, but because he didn't think anybody would understand it. So, as the story goes, when they need a character to kind of carry things forward, they recruit a deva, or a heavenly being. So, one of these came down. Brahma Sahampati came down and talked to the Buddha, and he says, "There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are falling away because they do not hear the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma." So the story has it that the Buddha decided then to teach. And he looked around for those who would be, who had a little dust in their eyes, and understood that his colleagues, some of his former colleagues were 150 miles to the north. So he walked up there and gave them the first sermon on the Dhamma. And I like to think of him kind of walking north 150 miles, saying, "How am I going to get this across?" And that's what we're going to talk about now. It's the second set of qualities of the Dhamma. And we start with well expounded. Remember, he said the first one was hard to see, hard to teach. So let's. I think it's instructive to consider the qualities of Dhamma in the chant, the ones that we're going to talk about, and against the backdrop of the Buddha's initial qualities, an initial take on this. First, there's an outstanding similarity, is that the Dhamma is to be experienced for themselves by the wise. That's first thing he said, last thing he said. And that's kind of our personal involvement and responsibility for understanding the teaching. But then there's some interesting differences. Instead of being a non-teaching Buddha, and they're or a Pacheka Buddha, we have well expounded as the Dhamma. He was not only a teacher, he was an exemplary teacher. Not only because he was smart, but because he could kind of sense what somebody was ready to hear and what they needed to hear. He's extremely, amazingly intuitive. Instead of hard to see, we have inviting one to come and see. Ehi pasiko, that's one of my favorite words. So it's no longer hard to see, it's come and see. And instead of beyond the scope of conjecture, I mean, that's still there, but it's here and now. It's inward leading. None of this conjecture stuff. Just here and now. This is very, very grounded. So there's a new emphasis on accessibility through practical and personal experience rather than just saying, gee, this is so hard. And I think that's kind of what the Buddha figured out in his way north, is a way to get this across to us. So my reflection on these things is I like to think about them as ways that I can listen to the Dhamma or read it so that I kind of get inside of it and it gets across a little bit easier. I just said that the Buddha taught his teachings to the individual and he had a deep intuitive insight. And he could get in and explain things at a very fine level of detail, and with concepts that would challenge anybody for if they wanted to be mentally challenged and get into the details. But he had this great. We're not going to do that tonight, fortunately. But we have this great penchant for one-liners. Like one of them is somebody asked him what the Dhamma was, and Buddha said, "In the seeing, only the seen, and in the hearing, only the heard." Now, that's each of these things is kind of like a little microscope, telescope, looking at the Dhamma from one side, and each of them has within it, by reflections, all the other parts. So, if you get into that part and you start trying to explain it or understand it, you get led into all these other things. Another one is, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. So, who did the Buddha say that to? Somebody that came up to one of these wandering ascetics. I mean, there are all these different schools back then. It was kind of like Marin in the 60s. And everybody wanted to know what the other teacher was talking about. Sometimes they were genuinely interested. Sometimes they wanted to pick a fight. Somebody came up and says, "What do you teach?" He says, "I teach suffering and the end of suffering." It may sound like, oh, just a throwaway line, but it's important. We'll talk about a little later about what he didn't say and why that was important as well. Another one is, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. He gave that instruction to his monks who'd been meditating for a while. And here's how it came up. He said, form, monks, is not self. Form meaning, you know, the bodily form, form of the chair, the stars, whatever. Form, monks, is not self. If form were the self, this form would not lend itself to discomfort, to suffering. It would be possible to say with regard to these forms, let this form be thus, let this form be not thus. And it's like, I wish my back didn't hurt. I wish I weren't getting old. My teeth weren't loose. Can't do that. It says, but precisely because form is not self, form tends to suffering. And it is not possible to say with regard to form, let this form, let me not hurt, etc. And then it goes on and does the same thing with feelings, how we feel. We can't control our feelings. They're uncomfortable. With perceptions, we can't control what we see sometimes. Sometimes we see things we don't like. So you say, okay. So you can hear the monks saying, okay, it's not my body, but it's my thoughts, right? Then the Buddha starts to pull a rug out. He says, mental fabrications and thoughts are not the self because we can't control them and they're uncomfortable. And consciousness is not the self because we can't control that either. So what the Buddha is saying here is, he says, what do you think, monks? Is consciousness constant or inconstant? Inconstant, Lord. And he says, and is it fitting to regard that which is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change? This is mine, this is myself, that is what I am? He says, no, Lord, it is not. So what the Buddha did is, that's the Buddha's teachings on non-self. You notice that he never got up and said, okay, guys, take notes, there is no self. He didn't say that. He said, if you look at the body, you're not going to find it. If you look at the feelings, you won't find it. If you look at your thoughts and consciousness itself, you won't find anything that gives you a permanent sense of identity and some security. And that was kind of his way of teaching. He didn't go out and give big metaphysical, cosmological statements. Instead, he put things in experiential terms that you could check out for yourself. You didn't have to rely on his authority. You might want to later, but initially you don't have to. There's another famous story where somebody actually tried to get the Buddha to say, "Oh, you know, look, I've been meditating here for a while. I really want the inside scoop. You know, following the breath, that's fine. But what I really want to know is, I want to know about, you know, is the cosmos eternal? Is it not eternal? Is it finite? Is it infinite? Are the soul and the body the same? The soul is one thing and the body is another. After death, the Buddha exists. After death, he does not exist. After the death, he both exists and does not exist, or neither exists nor exists." I mean, this is kind of a ploy they had. It's like, okay, one, the other, both, neither. It's like, okay, I've got you boxed in. Tell me what you are. And this is, you know, kind of a walk up and check out this monk under this tree and stuff. People came up to the Buddha. So one of his own monks decided to do that. And he went up to the Buddha and asked him about these things. And Buddha said to him, "Look, did I ever say to you, if you come and, you know, meditate with me, live with me, I tell you about whether the universe is infinite or whether the body and the soul are the same?" He says, "No, you didn't." And the Buddha says, let me tell you what you sound like to me. And I take this as not, the Buddha's not just giving the guy a hard time. This is kind of a admonition for us. I read this and say, oh, okay. I would be ill-advised to expect to find that in my studies as well. So then the Buddha says, "You remind me of a guy who was hit by a poison arrow. And his friends take him to the doctor and says, 'We got to take that arrow out.' And he says, 'No, wait a second. You can't take that arrow out until I know who shot it at me.' Was he a guy from my clan or another clan? Was he a Brahmin? Was he an untouchable? And I want to know what the arrow was made from, what kind of wood it was made from, you know, the fletching, what kind of bird did that come from? Where was the poison made of? Was it made from some berries or the juice of some vine or something like that? And the Buddha goes on. You can just see the monk just you know, cringing. And he says, that's what it's like. He says, you've got this poison arrow in you, which is suffering, and you're here wanting to know all of these speculative things, and I'm trying to get the arrow out. He says, you know, we're not going to waste our time on that. Not because I don't know, but because you don't need to. So that's kind of, the Buddha always comes back to what's going to help us out, and there's a lot of stuff he just doesn't get into because it's not important for his teaching. We may find out that it's important for what we want to do in life. But that's cool, but he's not going to spend his time talking about various topics. I'll get back to what may be important to us that the Buddha didn't talk about in a bit. Then sanditiko akaliko. Those are the words for to be seen here and now and timeless. I want to talk about these together. I look at this in three ways. There's a sense of urgency, of results here and now, and being constantly relevant. And the sense of urgency, there are two words in Pali, sanvega and pasada, I think. Basically, it's like, gee, this is important. I just woke up to how important this is. Maybe you'll have something, your parents die. You get a near miss in an auto accident. Something happens, you say, you know, there are some things that are important. I have to understand what they are. And I've heard about this. This seems to me to be important. And boy, am I glad I have a chance to study it. I've got some personal stories. I mean, this is some personal stories here. I was in the mid-70s, I was lived in Minneapolis, and I was walking through the snow to the university where I was going to school. I saw this guy walk right in front of me. I said, my gosh, that's a Zen priest. And he smiled at me. He's a Japanese guy. He smiled at me. He says, oh, I went into that house there. I'll have to go back there and check it out. I never did. Never even thought to go back. And years later, I figured out there was Dainin Katagiri Roshi. He's a student of Suzuki Roshi, famous guy. I just walked right by. I could have said, hey, excuse me. I never did it. In the mid-80s, I was in Burma, and I was just traveling around. And I was walking around the Shwedagon Pagoda, which is the big catsy one you see the picture of. And this English-speaking Burmese monk came up and said, hey, you want to come back here? There's an Englishman back here who's been a monk for 30 years. You want to talk to him? I said, yeah, sure. We went back, and he said, oh, I'm sorry, it's noontime, the monk's eating, he can't eat again until tomorrow. Can you come back in a little bit? And I says, oh yeah, well, I really got to want to see the pagoda and get in the train and go north tomorrow. So I never did it. And I've been kicking myself about both of those things for a long time. So when I got this place here and the teachers and stuff like that, I'm really happy to be here. Don't let it happen to you. I mean, if you think this is important, hang on. It may not be here, maybe somewhere else, but don't let yourself get in a situation where you're going to regret not having taken advantage of one of these opportunities that's in the Bay Area. Then the results here and now. I mean, you know, it's not like you're going to get enlightened soon or anything like that. I mean, maybe some of us will. But for most of us, it's a little more gradual. And it might not be what you expect. Sometimes you hear from people saying, oh, I've been meditating for 3 months now or a year now, and it's not working. In fact, I'm angrier now. I think more about these embarrassing situations I went through when I was a kid. This isn't working. I thought I was supposed to be peaceful, right? Well, what's happening is it is working. It's just not what you expected. The person that's saying this has actually developed some inclination and strength of mind to kind of sit with what's happening, and sooner or later, one of these angry thoughts walks past and he sees it clearly. He may have been pushing it away, had his defenses up or his own personal armor or stories up so high. He never saw that. But as he watches the breath more clearly and the mind gets stronger, he looks at some of these things and he sees those and he thinks, I'm getting more angry. I mean, that can happen. But as you see more things, you can also get more self-acceptance, more equanimity with things. Remember that the Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering? He said you have to understand both. Most of us want to start in the second semester and just go to the end of suffering. But he said you have to understand suffering, to understand it through and through to its core. Not because he's a masochist, because he says that's the way out. If you understand the mechanism, then you can get free. Because most of us just say, well, yeah, I'm suffering. And we've said this for how many years, how many lifetimes, and we haven't gotten out of it yet. The Buddha says you really have to understand it. Ever relevant. It's the third one I want to mention under this. I've also called this applications to daily life without being defined by daily life. This part of the talk is actually a matter of some discussion. There are lots of opinions on either side, and I encourage you to have your own informed opinion. This can be of special interest to householders because Buddhism tries to take root in Western soil because, you know, we're busy, we've got all these things to do. So sometimes we bump into, we think, oh, Buddhism is, it's a really skillful, a really powerful way of psychology. Because, look, didn't I just see that I was more angry? And didn't I just start to understand some of what was going on in my life? Maybe that's what this is about. That's certainly what I need in my life. Deeper understanding of this and, you know, better feeling about myself. And then other people may say, I've said this myself, is, you know, the Buddha sounded like he was kind of a cold fish. I mean, he didn't talk about, he said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering, but he didn't say there's suffering because there's too much injustice or because there's war or environmental degradation or unresolved issues with my parents. He's not talking about any of the things that kind of hit me in the face when I look in the newspaper. So I think that the way that I look at both of these things, one of which is just to draw us into the mundane everydayness of getting through life, and another one, you know, look like you're not relevant at all, is to understand the difference between content and process. And this is what I mean by that. Lost here. So, example, when we look at, you know, when we sit and we meditate and we start to see things, it may be anger, it may be the relationships with our parents. We may go farther, and that, at some level, that's content. That's saying, oh, that's a story about myself, about me being angry or being betrayed or cheated or something like that. That's content. Process is the way that I grab onto things, or I push them away, or I'm confused about them. That's what the Buddha saw in general. So rather, and what the meditation practice we do wakes us up to the general process of being, of grabbing on, of pushing away, or being confused, and helps us break that down. Along the way, we'll see various pieces of content, but that's an example of, but not the boundary of the power of this practice. So if we think, okay, this is what it is. It's about understanding coming up with a better life story. We're missing part of it. The Buddha wasn't about making a better life story. He's about getting us to stop telling stories, because whenever we told a story about form or feeling or perception or thoughts or consciousness, we got ourselves into trouble and we continued to suffer. He wanted us to stop telling those stories and get out of suffering. Similarly, you know, how relevant is Buddhism to whatever, the war? The Buddha actually stopped the war once, but he didn't spend his lifetime going around and stopping wars. He spent his lifetime talking about getting out of suffering. So he was really talking about, if he were to address a war or injustice or environmental degradation, he might focus, I believe he would focus, on the suffering that arises from the way that we... The suffering that arises from the way that we hold our thoughts about it. Not that environmental degradation or the war isn't painful, but stopping these things, there'll just be another cause of suffering beyond that. If we stop one war, there'll be another one. We got out of Vietnam and we're about to go back into Iraq. We didn't, you know, there's still the mechanism, the process is still churning away. There's a story I heard once. This one woman said, was relating her experiences, and she says, you know, when I first started hearing about the Buddha's teachings, and I was really excited. I wanted to tell everybody about it because it meant a lot to me and it was making some difference in my life. And my friends just weren't interested. So I stopped talking to them about that and paid attention to my practice. And I got a little less angry or snippy or patient or something like that. And my friends, I got along better with my friends. He says, you know, they liked me better when I was a Buddha than when I was a Buddhist. So maybe it's, you know, if you want to get involved in something, maybe it's not because you're a Buddhist, but as a Buddhist. Certainly if you're going to get involved in political action or do anything, there's going to be plenty of chances to go crazy, to get angry with people, to run short of compassion. And maybe this practice will help you go through that, not lead you into it, but help you get through it. Whatever you feel called to do, there will certainly be demands on you that I think you'll be better prepared to meet with a good practice. Ehi Passiko, come and see. That's the Buddha's approach to teaching. And there was no leap of faith required. Maybe the founder of that faith didn't say it, but some disciples of that faith say, it's a leap of faith. This is great stuff. It can only be understood from the inside. You know, make the leap, get inside, and you'll see how it works for you. I'm not saying that's bad, but that's not what the Buddha did. He said, come on up, investigate it, come back again if you want. Take part of it, try it out, see if it works. And that's kind of like the introductory aspect. It's not the whole teaching, but he says, try this out. See if, does it lead to reduction in suffering in your life and in other people's lives? Okay. Try something more. Meditate and see if you understand a little bit more about impermanence and if that allows you to be a little bit latched up about changes in your life, etc. He did that, and people have been doing that for 2,500 years. The Dalai Lama right now is having, I think he'll do it again this spring, every two years he's been having conferences with neuroscientists, and they get together, I think this year it's at MIT, and they'll talk about what neuroscientists and what meditators know about the mind. And he's like, hey, just come and see. I'm not afraid. Not like I've got to hide anything or be afraid of somebody getting in and undermining my teachings. It's just right here. And in fact, some of the things that they talk about when the neuroscientists get some of these advanced Tibetan meditators in their labs start talking about it, they just blow them away. Daniel Goleman's got a new book out, or it will be coming out, when he talks about this. In fact, one of the neuroscientists had these people, these advanced Tibetan meditators in his lab, and he actually got interested in meditation, but not because what the dials and the charts said, because he got excited about their presence. and their quality, just their quality of being. So that's come and see. There is a role for faith and authority in the practice, though. It's not just, well, check it out for you, you know, try it out for yourself, make your own rules and all that. And faith in the way that we understand it is actually important. It's not faith like, I really believe this is going to happen later. If I have these beliefs, this will happen. And that's kind of a naive sense in which some of us hold faith. In our tradition, faith is confidence in the practice to be able to sit in the cushion and let it work its stuff. And that may just be, you may start off with saying, yeah, I can really sit here for a half an hour without going crazy, just following my breath. Or I can sit here when my leg really hurts. But I'm going to look at it and see if I can understand that there's a difference between that this pain is not mine. There's some way in which I get abstracted from the pain and I don't have to suffer as much. I may hurt physiologically, I may know there's pain, but I might not have to suffer. Or I don't know how I'm going to get through with this. I'm a single mother and I'm out of work and my parents just died. I don't know how I'm going to get through that. I mean, you know, maybe you say, okay, I'm going to rely on the teachings for that. And that's the quality of faith. Not saying, oh, sure, it'll be okay, but if I do my work, the practice will do its work. I think that is important for us. I mean, you don't have to rush out and get it, but when it happens to you, it's precious stuff. Guard it. Hope it grows. In fact, they talk about three levels of faith. They talk about bright faith, verified faith, and unshakable faith. And bright faith is the kind of this woman I talked about before. She had just, you know, read a book or heard the Dalai Lama at Shoreline or something like that and is really excited about it. Then there's verified faith, where, and I think a lot of us have that, is he says, you've checked it, you've gone to see, you've checked it out for yourself, and everything you can check out is right. It works. It balances out. And it's right not in the sense of just checking it off, but it means something to you. You say, yeah, I heard these words before, and I read books, but until I saw it for myself, I didn't know it was like this. It's kind of like the same words, just a different meaning. It's richer, a little bit richer. You say, yeah, that really works. That's verified faith. And then at some level, I'm not there yet, although many, many teachers are, you get unshakable faith. It's like, you've been through enough stuff with this, you've seen the power of the teachings, that you know that whatever comes up, you can handle. Not only does it work in general, but it works for you. And I think that's the kind of thing that will get us, when each of us get that, it'll help us through a lot of rough spots. And, let's see. Opanayiko, pachitam vidito bo vinyuhiti. Okay, opanayiko is variously inward leading and onward leading, and that three-word phrase means to be experienced for themselves by the wise. I think the inward leading and the onward leading is really finding freedom within. It's not like in an external deity or external belief system. It's not finding it in philosophy or in our actions in the world or something like that. We can do all of those things, but that's not what the Buddha was teaching. He didn't say we couldn't do that, you know, be active in the world or whatever. Those are our beliefs. If we want to do those as Buddhists, that's fine. But the Buddha was actually talking about something much more personal and inward. So here's a story. Again, the interlocutor is Dewa, a heavenly being, comes down to see the Buddha and says, is it possible, Lord, by traveling, to know or see a far end of the cosmos where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear? So he's asking me, like, if I go to the far end of the universe, can I actually find a place where I get out of suffering, where I get out of the wheel of death and rebirth, where all of this ends? And so this heavenly being is talking about, you know, I'm just going to speed of light. I'm going to go to the end of the universe, you know, peek behind the quasars, whatever. And we can take that as like, well, special practices or special philosophies or speculation or something like that. Anything that takes us out and away, I invite that reading of this text here. And the Buddha said no. He says, I tell you, friend, that it is not possible by traveling to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear. Okay, might think that if the sutta ended there, it wouldn't be very interesting, he says. But at the same time, I tell you that there is no making an end of suffering and stress without reaching the end of the cosmos. Okay, you can't get there by traveling, but you can't get release without it. What do you do? The Buddha continues, yet it is just within this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and intellect, that I declare that there is a cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. That's the Four Noble Truths, dressed up a little bit different. So the Buddha said, he says, in this fathom-long body, and in your perceptions, in your mind, that's where it is. It's not outside. It's inside, in our perceptions. That's why we started tonight by following our breath and feeling if our nose twitched or noticing if we had a thought about, oh, gee, I'm glad tomorrow's Friday, or saying, gee, I was gone for a while. I just got back. We started that, and that's the first step. And when the Buddha was asking his monks, he says, you know, is form, the physical body, is that permanent? Is that satisfactory? They said no, and they said no from a very deep place because they've been looking at it for a long time. And they said the same about, you know, perception and feelings and thoughts, consciousness. That's where this is going. So we start by sitting down and breathing and getting the strength to put up with our foot falling asleep or knowing that we're angry, knowing that we've been angry, just like our brother's been telling us for all these years. Getting the faith to hang out when our knee really hurts or all this stuff we never wanted to tell anybody. Stuff that happened in junior high school that was so embarrassing is coming and staying with us days at a time, just hanging through there. I think that's what it's about. So that's that. When I think about the qualities of Dhamma, that's what I think about it. About it being well expounded in these very personal terms, without metaphysics, to be seen here and now and timeless. It's stuff that makes sense today. We don't have to wait till the next lifetime for it to work. And it's endlessly relevant. It's not something that goes out of style. It has to be dressed up in new clothes to be, you know, latest and greatest. We can some of the translations aren't all that sexy, but the Buddha said the important stuff, and it's still important today as it was, just as it was 2,500 years ago. It's inviting one to come and see. Anybody can come up, check it out. You can do it yourself. It's inward leading. It doesn't get you scattered around. It leads you inward. It leads you onward. You taste a little bit. You get a little bit of strength, a little bit more inclination of mind. You can do some more. And the Buddha said it's something we each have to do for ourselves. And he wouldn't have said that if we couldn't do it for ourselves. Nobody else can do it for us. It's not a matter of just thinking nice thoughts. It's a matter of sitting down, putting up with forgetting about the breath or the knee being hurt, and then just following it inward and onward, taking it where it leads you. So that's what I wanted to talk about tonight. And I'd be interested in hearing if any of you have your own reflections on the Dhamma or questions about what I said. Did any of this make it, trigger a thought from anybody? Yes.
I had a question between two different things that you said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yes.
And I was intrigued by the idea that the person was like trying to tear it all apart, understand it, know all the different parts of it before he was willing to take it out.
Yeah.
And he was, and I guess the Buddha was saying, you know, you're trying to figure it out, and I'm just trying to take it out.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then later on, I heard you talk about, and you said there's suffering and there's a cessation of suffering that you have to do them in the right order. You can't just jump ahead to cessation of suffering, but you have to understand suffering first.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the difference is.
Oh, okay. That's a great question. Here's what I think the difference is. So this monk comes up to the Buddha. And he's been sitting there. You can imagine whether he's got a bad back or he's only eating one meal a day. He says, I don't want this stuff. He says, I want the juicy stuff. I want to know where the Buddha goes after death. I want to know about if the body and the soul are the same. I'm kind of tired sitting here following my breath day after day. I want something really sexy. One teacher, Joseph Goldstein, many of you may know him, said that a colleague of his, Sharon Salzberg, they were talking together 30 years ago when they were in India. And she said, you know, I've been following the in-breath and the out-breath for years now. I want to get on to the advanced stuff. And he said, well, it's too bad that she's not here today because I'm going to teach you the advanced stuff. It's not one breath at a time. It's a half a breath at a time. And that was the advanced teaching. There's, you know, this monk that wanted all the stories, he wanted some distraction from sitting down with boredom or the anger or the pain or something like that. And the Buddha says, no, get back, sit down, and pay attention. Did that help? No. Yes.
I'm still curious about what did it mean when the person who had the poison arrow in them wanted to actually be with the arrow, wanted to actually understand the arrow, and was told, oh, you don't have to do that. You can just take the arrow.
Oh. Yeah, but see, what the Buddha was saying was, what's important about this arrow is that you're going to die if you don't get it out. And we're here with a surgeon to do that. And he was saying, no, I really want to know what kind of arrows were on the arrow, or what kind of feathers were on the arrow, what was the bow made out of? Who shot it? He says, and the Buddha's saying, you're asking the wrong questions. Those, you know, I know those, but I'm not going to spend time talking to you about it because all the time we spend talking about it is time lost from understanding the suffering and getting rid of it. So when the Buddha said to understand suffering, it was in this experiential sense, sitting down and just paying attention to what happens. It wasn't in a kind of a theoretical or speculative sense where we're going to talk about are the body and the soul the same, this, that, and the other thing. He said, because that was a big inclination. It was in India. Very philosophical folks. It still is today. And whether we're just intellectually curious or whether we're avoiding the hard work or whatever, the Buddha's saying, I know that you're interested in that, but that's not it. So let's pay attention. The understanding comes from sitting down and living it, not from sitting back and talking about it. Yes.
That's being caught in the head.
Yeah.
In a sense. And that what actually is involved in recognizing the arrow is going to kill you and being willing to take it out, that is the actually being with what's coming up.
Right. And given the fact, and maybe the image is, You know this. There's no anesthetics, right? They have to cut the arrow out and pull it out. That's going to hurt. And he says, No. Tell me about this. What are the feathers first? Don't yank that arrow. What are the feathers? And so, oh no. And who shot it? He said, well, we're going to cut the arrow out. Is that okay? Will you stop asking questions? He says, I think it's more like that. That's a good question.
So I can spend a lot of time wondering how we got to this situation. Like, you know, why is she upset? What did we say? What was the situation that made her upset? And maybe that's the same thing as trying to speculate about the arrow versus just being able to stay with the pain in the moment that I feel about the alienation and somehow be able to let go of that pain. Is that a similar analogy?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. And that's actually a harder one to deal with for us because we're so psychologically oriented. And although not a lot of us get shot with arrows, all of us have those kind of hurts. And some of us have really benefited from, you know, from help, from friends or a professional or something like that. And that's when I said, you know, when I said there's a lot of... This is an area of active discussion, and you know some people are you know it's not clear. I mean everybody's not uniform about it. People may have strong opinions. In the Bay Area, you'll find a lot of people that will say no. This is really very very helpful in exactly the kind of situation you want because it gives you clarity to deal with it. But I had a different experience. I sat with it really came home to me when I sat with a Burmese monk once. And I was going into my interview, and I was going to tell him, boy, you know, I really understood something. And I had this great thing about my family of origin, you know, my father, my brothers, whatever it was. And I started going on, and he just cut me off like that. And I was upset. I mean, this is going to be good stuff. I had great material, and I just wanted to talk to this guy about this thing that I had understood. And it took me about a day or two of being mad, and then I realized, you know, he didn't want me to have a better story. He wanted me to stop the stories. And it's a little now. The flip side of that is that Burmese monks aren't terribly psychologically astute. I mean, in some ways they are, but they're not. Maybe that's a misstatement. But if you want to work with somebody on that basis, it's probably you're not going to get it from working with a lot of Burmese monks, right? It's kind of grist for the mill. It's something to think about. I think that what you're saying there is that you're going to get through it farther. If you can get acquainted with your own pain and the mechanisms of your own pain and what you grab onto and stuff, rather than get wrapped up in more thoughts about trying to, you know...
How did we get here and what was the dynamic? And
right, you know...
I mean, there's got to be a sort of level beyond that psychological level that, you know, a lot of us have experience in. I mean, if meditation is offering something, then it's offering some resolution on a different level.
Yes, I think so, and that's what I was trying to get across with my the distinction between content and process. So, if you're dealing with the content in your situation is this the storyline about this very uncomfortable relationship, you know that's the content level. The process level is Buddhist. Okay, now hang back. Can you see what happens? Can you see these thoughts as they come to you? Can you get comfortable enough with them so you don't have to tell another story? You know, can you get comfortable enough with it just to see through it? There's another story I've heard about I didn't know this guy, but he's a Vietnam vet. And had, I think he's a medic in Vietnam. It's horrible stuff, horrible stuff. And he got back, and every night that he had gotten, since he got back, he woke up with cold sweats. He's having flashbacks. And he went in a meditation retreat, and he sat in his cushion, and he was having the flashbacks while he was sitting. But he sat there, probably drenched in sweat or something like that. And when he left that retreat, he never had him again. You know, not because he succeeded in telling a different story or whatever, but he went through it. He went through it, and it dropped away. So I think that, you know, as you do this more, I started to see hints of it myself, pieces of the mechanism fall away. Because we can solve the thing about a relative or something like that. But we just kind of patched it over. The way we got into trouble about that, about holding on to this image of ourselves or being whatever, that's still there and it'll hurt us later on something else. But if we can sit through that and see it clearly enough, it's kind of like maybe like seeing the strings in a puppet show. I mean, the puppets are still moving, but it doesn't have the same magic. And we're not sucked into the story as much. So that's what I was talking about with content versus process. And I think that this work here gets us in touch directly with the underlying, the fundamental process of suffering and how to start letting go of pieces of it.
So the idea is then to let go of it after the suffering or whatever, the discomfort with the situation.
I think the goal is for it to drop away. But if we say let go of it, then that can get into I have to pretend it's not important or something like that, and maybe we're not ready to. And I say that because I have tried to let go of things as I'm supposed to let go of this. And I said okay, I'm going to try just to let this go, and I won't pay attention to this part of it, or I'll say yeah fine, do this or whatever. And boy, it came back and hit me in the face. I wasn't prepared to let go of it skillfully. I wanted to do it because I thought it was the right thing to do, but I wasn't in touch with the problem and my relationship to it or whatever. I wasn't in touch with the mechanism enough for that to happen naturally. So if we pay, sit here and follow the breath or our uncomfort with our relative or something like that, and things will start to fall away naturally, and we'll, rather than saying, I'm supposed to do this. The philosophy says that this is a good thing. It's not a bad thing to see that as a goal and recognize it when it happens, but if you force it and you do it wrong, you may end up causing yourself more suffering. Which doesn't mean you can try in small things, but don't try it for the first time in something really big. Which is what I did. I mean, not for the first time. He says, if I can get through this, I really have it. I'm still suffering. Got a couple minutes if anybody has another. Okay, then let's sit for just a few minutes and start the work we were talking about. May the merit of our practice together tonight be joined with the meritorious deeds of the past, present, and future, and together be dedicated to the welfare, the happiness, and the freedom of all beings.